Okay, so let's get started here. So I just want to confirm the date for the midterm. It's going to be on April 9th at 6 in the evening. It's an evening exam, next room, okay, 6 to 8. Closed book, closed notes. Okay, the midterm is usually closed book. The final is open book, take home. That's the way we usually do it. That's what we are going to do. I will send out sometime next week maybe a sample exam from last time or something like that. Okay, just so that you get some idea of what to expect in the exam. Okay, but usually it's what you cover in the class is what you should focus on. Okay, the book will have details. You should certainly read up on that. But if there are stuff in the book that we haven't covered in class, you don't really have to bother about it. Okay. All right. So let's get started. So last time we stopped here, which was concurrency control, and this was basically, so recall that we were talking about transactions and I mentioned asset properties and so on, and the specific problem we were looking at is how do you let multiple transactions execute in the system so you get the benefit of parallelism but make sure that there are no conflicting operations. Okay, so we looked at, so that's the problem of concurrency control. Okay, so ensure that consistency is maintained even though multiple transactions are executing. Okay, so we looked at the first approach was optimistic concurrency control. And here the transaction is basically executing without any locks in the system. Okay, so just let transactions execute. They do whatever they want, but before the transaction commits, you validate. Okay, so you see if the transaction did something that conflicts with some other transaction that has already committed. Okay, if so, you would you abort the transaction. Okay, now I mentioned that this is not widely used because when the load goes up, the fraction of transactions that have to abort keeps increasing. Okay, because the probability that any two transactions access the same data item goes up as the number of transactions increases. Okay. So what we are going to look at next is what is referred to as pessimistic concurrency control. So here you take a more conservative approach. Okay, here you will use locks and you will make transactions wait if the lock it is trying to acquire is held by some other transaction. Okay, so you avoid the need to abort because of conflicting operation. Okay, so you use locks to prevent conflicts altogether. So this is a widely used concurrency control technique. This is actually used in many commercial, some flavor or variant of this is used in all commercial databases. Okay, so what happens here is the scheduler is where all the locking takes place. You remember the picture I showed last time. There is the transaction manager, the scheduler, and the data manager. Okay, the scheduler is the one that's responsible for locking. So scheduler acquires all locks in the growing phase. Okay, and there is, so there are two phases here, a growing phase in the transaction and a shrinking phase. So in the growing phase, you acquire locks as you touch each new data item. And in the shrinking phase, you release these locks. Okay. So what's happening here is if you think of a database as a sequence of records, okay, you have record level locking. A record is a data item. Okay, it doesn't have to be records, but let's assume that the record is a data item. So before you touch any data in that record, you have to get a lock. Okay. So as the transaction executes, if there is a new data item, it has suddenly started accessing, you first have to get a lock before any operation on the data item is performed. Okay. So that happens in the growing phase, and in the shrinking phase, if you're done with that data item and you know that you're not going to access it anymore until the end of the transaction, you can start releasing lock. Okay. So you have to check if the operation conflicts with existing locks. If so, meaning you as in the scheduler is going to check when a lock is requested, and if so, you will block that transaction and make it wait until the lock on that data item is released. Okay, and you never release a lock until you are done with that data item. That is a given. Okay, now the problem here is that deadlocks are possible. Okay, if you don't acquire locks in a careful order, okay, you may have two transactions that are operating on data items, and they will acquire locks in a certain order that causes deadlocks. Okay, this should be clear. If you do know anything about synchronization, this is pretty standard stuff. Okay, so let's assume that there are two data items, A and B. So transaction 1 accesses them in order AB and transaction B accesses them in order BA. So this is the order in which T1 requests locks and this is the order in which T2 requests locks. So this can cause a deadlock clearly because T1 is going to get a lock on A and then it may block here and T2 is going to get a lock on B and is blocking here. So they are each waiting for the other to release the lock and neither will make progress. Okay? Same is true here. Okay, in a transaction, if there are many data items, if you don't acquire locks in proper order, you are going to have conflicts and that is something that scheduler has to take care of. So this picture is showing what the locking looks like. So this is time and this is the number of, the y-axis is the number of locks held by the transaction. So all this is showing is in the growing phase, you keep acquiring locks as you touch each data item, but you never release locks until you are done acquiring all the locks. Okay? And then in the shrinking phase, you start releasing locks. Okay, so this, so you, once you release a lock, you should never access that data item again. Okay, so you wait until you're done with all operations on that data item before you release the lock. In other words, you don't acquire a lock, release it, and then reacquire the lock on that data item in the same transaction. So that you don't do. Okay, there's a variant of two-phase locking, also called 2PL, which is called strict two-phase locking. So what happens here is that the shrinking phase is postponed to commit time. Okay, so all locks that are acquired are released all at once at commit time. So it doesn't, you don't release them one at a time before the transaction ends. Okay, so that's the difference. So it is basically a special case of the normal two-phase locks where you delay all of these releases to this point, which is the commit time. Okay. Now, what's the difference between the two? Right, what does this give you that the other one does not? Any thoughts here? Yes. Right. So, better protection against deadlocks. But let's assume that may be a possible reason. But let's assume the scheduler is intelligent enough that it's already figured out that you acquire locks in a certain order. So if you order all the records and you acquire locks in that order, then you are guaranteed that you will not have deadlocks. Okay, so that's so suppose there you have done that the scheduler is built in a way that is intelligent enough. So what would be the difference between the two in that case? Okay, so if deadlocks are not the issue.
Nobody can rewrite this stuff for 30
days. Yes. So the advantage of releasing locks at the very end is that any other transaction that wants to access a data item that you're already holding a lock on is going to have to wait until you commit. Okay, in other words, you cannot. So in the previous case, suppose that as soon as you release this lock, some other transaction can acquire the lock. Okay, and then it can do some operation on the lock, but this transaction hasn't yet committed. So this could cause a read-write conflict or a write-write conflict. Okay, so since you don't want to overwrite each other, so this may still cause a transaction to abort even though you have put locking in the scenario. Okay, so in the other case, since you are waiting until the transaction commits to release the lock, no other transaction will be able to perform any operation on the data item once you have grabbed the lock. Okay, so this reduces the probability of abort because of a write-write conflict. Okay. Now the disadvantage of this is it is going to reduce concurrency because more transactions are going to be blocked. Okay, in the previous case, as soon as you release the lock, some other transaction can acquire the lock and do something with it. Okay, so you get more parallelism, but higher chances of an abort. Okay, in the other case, it's the other way around. Yes, no, your question. Right. So what does two-phase locking give us? So I haven't gone into all the details of the properties and so on. So there are papers that were written on this which say if you actually have the growing and the shrinking phase and you impose certain order, you get deadlock-free operation. Okay, so this is basically the idea. Otherwise, if you acquire, release locks, right? So there is no way to guarantee that the system won't deadlock. So they impose these restrictions to ensure deadlock-free operation. And there are, if you go back, these papers are now about 20 years or old, there are properties that have been shown for two-phase locking, saying this is what you get out of this. Any questions here? Yes, you have a question.
I'm having trouble understanding how a conflict could occur with non-strict two-phase locking, because
okay.
if some other process wants to use, like I can't see how a data item in here could conflict with something with
okay.
some other transaction if a lock is still held in this transaction.
Okay, so the problem occurs when you release a lock.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there are a few things to keep in mind. The changes you have made within a transaction are not going to be made visible until commit time. This we remember from last time, right? So, or they are not durable until commit time. Okay? So, several problems could occur. So let's suppose you release. So here you have released a lock, right? So some other transaction could acquire a lock, okay? And when you held the lock, you may have actually modified the data item. Okay. Some other transaction, but you may not make that. If you use private workspaces, you are not going to make this change visible until this point in time. You have modified it, but it's not visible to other transaction. You just held a lock there. Okay. Now, some other transaction could come and access that data item, and it's using an old data. Okay. So when you commit, and then that transaction commits later, it sees it actually used some old data for its computation, so it has to abort and restart. This is just one example. Okay. There are many such scenarios. The other problem is cascading aborts, right? So if you basically release this lock, other transaction, suppose you do in-place updates, then that was right.
Sorry, and then if you abort.
If you abort here, then somebody else has read your data and made some changes, right? So all sorts of problems could occur, regardless of whether you use private workspaces or in-place updates. Okay? Any other questions? You cannot, okay. So the problem with normal two-phase locking is that it increases the chances of other transactions aborting. There are several examples of this. So let's assume that you released, you held a date lock on, let's say, variable A. You made some changes to variable A, and you released the lock here. Okay. So now some other transaction, before you finish, some other transaction could grab that lock because you have released the lock. So it grabs that lock and it uses your modified value of A to do some computation. But later on, if this transaction aborts, you will force the other one to abort, because when you abort, you will undo your changes to A. So that transaction is forced to abort because it's using a value that has been undone. Okay. In the second case, this will not happen because you hold the lock until commit time. So the other transaction would never even have started because you are waiting until it. So this is one example. Here the other example is a private workspace where you have made a change, but it is not yet visible. Okay, so if some other transaction gets hold of the lock and this one commits, then that one is using an older data.
So the number of locks here, it means so they are different locks on the same?
Different locks. So each lock is for a data item. So it's assumed that if you access a variable A, you grab lock on A. If you access variable B, you grab a lock on B, C, and so on. So you are grabbing locks as you access them. Okay? Any other questions here? Okay. So the next approach is to use the timestamps, the notion of logical clocks, to do concurrency control. So here what happens is every transaction is given a timestamp. This is Lamport's timestamp, not a physical timestamp. And if let's say it's transaction TI, if TI wants to perform an operation that conflicts with another transaction, then you use the notion of timestamps to figure out which one has to abort and which one gets to finish. Okay? So you basically abort if your timestamp is less than the other one. Okay, so the basic idea is if there are two transactions that are running concurrently, okay, and one has a smaller timestamp than the other, let's call the first one an older transaction and the second one a newer transaction. Okay. So if a newer transaction has already modified a data item and an older transaction wants to now later on go and modify that data item, you do not allow that. Okay, so you basically say a newer transaction has already modified it. I am an older transaction, so I abort and I restart with a higher timestamp. Okay, so you basically only allow data items to be modified in timestamp order of transactions, rather than and if you have a conflict, then you basically abort. Okay, and I'll show an algorithm that basically does this. So the way this can be implemented is for every data item that you have a lock or you want to grant a lock, you keep the max timestamp. Okay, so this is the transaction with the highest timestamp that has either read or written. Okay, so if the read timestamp is the max timestamp of a transaction that has read that value, and max write timestamp is the timestamp of the transaction that has returned to that variable. Okay, so this is basically what you do. If some transaction I wants to read X, then you basically compare your timestamp to the max timestamp of the data item. And if a newer transaction has read it, that max timestamp is going to be higher than your own timestamp. Okay, then you abort. Otherwise, you perform the read and then you update the timestamp. The same is true of write. If basically your timestamp is less than the read timestamp, which means some newer transaction has read it or some newer timestamp transaction has returned to it, then you would abort. Otherwise, you will let the write go ahead and then you again update the write timestamp. Okay, so if you do this, then you are using a notion of Lamport's clock to impose an ordering on the transactions and how they access individual data items. And this prevents write-write conflicts or read-write conflicts. Okay, is this clear? Any questions here?
Oh, yes.
What's the timestamp of a transaction? So timestamp, so this is just using Lamport's clock, right? So you basically just use Lamport's clocks to get a timestamp. So for example, if these are all running on the same machine, you can just have a transaction start up and it has to get a timestamp that is higher than all the other timestamps that have been
up.
Yes, whenever a transaction begins, you get a timestamp. Any questions here?
In the entire scenario, we are getting a timestamp when
start. Yes. Whenever you start, you say this is the time. So think of a timestamp as my start time. Okay. So a newer transaction is one that started after me. So if a newer transaction has already modified some data item and I'm an older transaction and I want to do that, that's not allowed. Okay. Because you want data items to be modified in time order. That's time order as in timestamps of the transaction order. So that's the basic idea. Okay, so this is just an example which I'm going to skip. And then, so that is basically what we have to say on concurrency control. And the next two things I'm going to start talking about now, which are somewhat related to some other topics we have, but this is really a new chapter in the book, is on consistency and replication. Okay, so I'll talk about several consistency models, that some that are data centric and some that are client centric. Okay, we probably will not get done with both of these things today, but let me start. Okay, so I'm going to start with some high level intuition behind replication and what this biases and so on. Okay, so by replication here we mean data replication, not service replication. Okay, so server replication we'll come back to later on, but this is just replication of data. So what this means is, if you have some data item, okay, there are multiple copies of it in your system. Okay, you have replicated it on different machines. Okay, now why would you want to do it? Why would you do data replication? It turns out that this is very common, and there are usually two reasons you want to replicate. One is reliability or high availability, and the other one is performance. Okay, so the reliability or high availability just says that if you have multiple copies and one copy goes away for whatever reason, machine crashes, disk crashes, or the service becomes unavailable, you can still go to the other copy and the data item remains accessible. Okay, so that's reliability. The other reason to do this is performance. Okay, so performance says that if you just have one copy of a data item in your system, the machine that it resides on or the disk that it resides on has some capacity. Okay, so if the demand on the data item is higher than capacity, then some requests are going to get queued up or turned away. Okay, now if you have multiple copies, this you can take your incoming requests and you can split it among the replicas, and each replica serves as a fraction of the workload. This allows you to scale the capacity of your system. So there are two reasons. So either reliability or performance. Okay, in performance, you can scale with the size of the system. So that's replicated web server, or scale in geographical terms, which is web proxies. And we'll come to both of these and see how you can use replication to achieve both of these goals when we talk about the web. Okay, that's chapter 12, so it's a few lectures away. But regardless of why you're replicating, whether it's for reliability reason or performance reasons, there's a fundamental problem you have to address with replication, which is to maintain consistency of that data item. Okay, so what happens now is, let me just draw a picture here. So let's suppose there are multiple disks and you have a file. Okay, the data item in this case could just be a file. Same file is replicated on three disks. Okay. Now if you modify this file, let's say you go and update this file here, okay, then you have the problem of making sure that these updates are propagated to these other two disks. Okay, this is the problem of maintaining consistency. If you don't, then requests to that access these files on these two disks are going to see an older copy of that data, meaning an older version of the file. It could be as simple as your web page. Okay, if you have replicated your web server on multiple machines, you update your web page, you write something to your web page, and you only update it on the primary replica, and these updates are not propagated, any requests that are coming to these two replicas are going to see old copies of your web page. So you want to ensure consistency of the data. So if one copy is modified, others become inconsistent and this update has to be propagated. Okay. Now we will see several consistency algorithms a little later. Okay. Before we even talk about how do you maintain consistency, what we are going to talk about are consistency models. Okay. So for this, let's try to understand first at a high level who maintains consistency, okay, who is responsible for consistency. There are two approaches. One is you put the response burden of consistency on the application. The other one is you have put the burden on the system, which typically means middleware. Okay? So that's shown in these two pictures here. So here you have this data item. It's an object in this case. It could be a file or data item. And there's some application that is responsible for maintaining this data item. And it's the application's job to ensure consistency, which means that if a write comes to this data item, it's the application's job to figure out that this is changed and make sure the write is propagated here and both of them are updated. Okay. In the other case, you put this burden on the system. Okay. So it could be a middleware or it could be a distributed file system. You just update it in one location and it's the file system's responsibility to track how many copies of this object exist and to make sure all of those copies are updated. Okay. So the system application doesn't do anything. It just writes to any copy. And the system figures out behind the scenes how to propagate this write to all copies. Okay? So these are two approaches. In either case, you have to, depending on what guarantee you provide on consistency, we'll have consistency semantics. And that's what we are going to talk about. Actually there's one more issue here. So the other issue is that of replication and scaling. Okay, so I already mentioned that by keeping multiple replicas, you can scale the capacity of the system. Okay? But this is not always a given. Okay? In other words, you have to figure out what performance you need and what consistency overhead you incur and try to figure out whether the performance needs are greater than the cache maintenance or the consistency maintenance need. Okay? So here is an example to show you that replication doesn't always buy you a lot. Okay, so example is one where there's an object that is replicated n times in the system, and the object has a read frequency of r and a write frequency of w. So what this means is the object is read r times every time units, and it's updated w times every time units. Okay. Now, every time it is updated or written to, you have the consistency overhead of propagating this write to all other replicas. So that's this overhead that you have to bear for replicating. Okay? But every time you read, you get the benefit of replication because you can go to any replica and you can go in some sense to the closest replica, get good performance and so on. Okay? Now, if the read frequency is significantly smaller than the write frequency, then your cache your consistency overhead dominates. Because every read triggers lots of messages, but there aren't enough writes. Yeah, so here I can draw a picture to show what's happening. Okay, so let's say Oh, this is time. Okay, single file, and let's assume that all the green arrows are writes. Okay, so these are writes to this data item over time. Okay. So you have to somehow figure out what's the relative frequency of writes and the relative frequency of reads in the system. Okay. So if the that case is where writes are much greater than reads. Okay. So what this means is that for several writes, you will have one read. Okay. So here, so in this case, I'm showing that for every three writes, you see a read. Okay. So let's suppose this is you see three writes an hour, and you see only one read an hour. Okay, this is the example. Now, the claim is that in this case, replication is not buying you much. Okay, from a performance standpoint, when you compare it to the cache, the consistency overhead, because every time you read, you have to broadcast that read to n data items because it's replicated n time. So, for every write is triggering n messages in your system because you have to update it. But this write is effectively wasted. Okay, this n messages that got triggered when this write happens is effectively wasted because nobody has read this version of the file. Okay, so this file gets overwritten by this write, that file got overwritten by this write, and then this is the version that somebody actually read. Okay, so the consistency overhead of these two writes have gone waste effectively in your system. So you paid this price for nothing. Okay, same is true here. So basically, so if you have a lot more writes in your system than reads, then your consistency overheads are going to be high. Okay, so you have to think carefully in that scenario whether you need need replication at all. Now, the normal scenario where you use replication is not this, but the other way around, which is for every write where, so this case was write this. So if you have this, which is the frequency of reads is very much greater than the frequency of writes. So after every write, you'll have several reads. Right, so these are all reads. So it now pays, it's okay to pay the cost of propagating this write to several replicas because this write is going to be read several times. In this file, this version of the file is going to be read several times. And then it's going to get updated again. And then you propagate that update to all replicas and it gets read several times and so on. Okay? This is typically what happens in the web scenario where you may update your web page, let's say sometime once in a week or once in a month, and then there are several reads that you see for your web page. Okay, the number of hits is typically greater than your write frequency, the update frequency. Okay, so it makes sense to replicate if you want to scale to large system because you are willing to pay the price because the read frequency is much greater than the write frequency. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind that you can always replicate, but you have to keep the consistency overhead in mind. The consistency overhead dominates, then it doesn't make sense. It just says that you are basically not going to get read many times. So it's better not to do a lot of replication or think about whether you want to do it at all. Okay. So next what I'm going to do is to explain what kind of semantics one could provide. Okay, I just said that every write is somehow propagated to all the replicas. Okay, but there are many semantics one could provide on when exactly that happened. Okay, and how this write gets visible to the reads at various replicas. And that gives you various semantics. Okay, so we'll talk about those next. So this is the picture to keep in mind for when I talk about semantics, which is that there is a data item that's replicated on several disks. Okay, and there are processes that are reading or writing to that data item. So we want to now ask the question that if it is updated anywhere, what do reads in the system see, okay, at any other replica? Okay, that's the basic question. Okay. Now, typically, consistency implies that you should always return the results of the most recent write. Okay, the most recent write is the most recent version that creates the most recent version of that data item. So, if the read returns the results of the most recent write, you are providing good consistency semantics. Okay. But determining what the most recent write is itself is a problem in a distributed system, and that gives you a range of semantics. Okay, starting from strict consistency. Okay, strict consistency is what you probably intuitively understand when we talk about consistency, which is any read always returns the result of the most recent write And here we'll assume that there's a global clock. So writes at different global clock and tight synchronization. So you somehow we'll assume that you can always order writes at any replica, okay, any arbitrary replica. And so you always know that this is the most recent write in the system. Okay. And so any read should always give you that version that got created, regardless of where the read is. Okay. Now this can be a problem because in real system network delays can be variable. Okay, so a simple example of why set consistency is problematic is as follows. Okay. Let's say two disks. Okay, and they are geographically separated. Okay, let's say the speed of light latency between them is delta. Okay, regardless of where they are, there is going to be some latency. Okay, that you cannot get any message from here to here faster than the speed of light. Okay, so there is some latency here. If you have this on the east coast and that on the west coast, you may have like 100 millisecond latency here. Okay, that's speed of light latency. So now what does strict consistency say? Let's suppose that a write arrives at time t. Okay, at this data, at this disk. Okay, and then a read arrives here at time t plus epsilon. Okay, where epsilon is slightly greater than t. Now, strict consistency says that this read should see the version that was created by that write, okay, because that read is later than this write. Okay, so, every read is returning the result of the most recent write. Okay, is that clear? So, this read, if you want to provide strict consistency, should basically return you whatever got written here. Okay. Now, the problem is that if this epsilon is smaller than delta, this is not going to be possible, okay, without making that read wait. Okay, because you cannot instantaneously propagate this update here. Okay, so suppose, just to put some values here, let's suppose this is t plus 1 millisecond, this latency is 100 milliseconds. Okay. So if you write here, even if you send that update immediately, it's going to take 100 milliseconds before that message even reaches this disk. Okay. This read has actually arrived here 1 millisecond after that write. Okay, so there is no way this read is going to return that unless you make it wait. Okay. So because of these real network delays, strict consistency is hard. Okay. So if you just return whatever was written here, then you have violated strict consistency because technically you should have returned this value, not that value. Okay. Is that clear? Is this clear or not? Okay, so strict consistency is hard to achieve. It's not impossible. We'll see ways to do this later on. But it is hard to achieve because of network delays. Okay. So that leads to the question, what kind of semantics can you actually provide in systems? And we'll now try to weaken the notion of strict consistency and we'll see several variants. Okay, this provides some guarantee, but it's not strict consistency. I mean, it's not strict consistency. So the next one is what we'll call sequential consistency. Okay, this is weaker than strict. So what happens here is that it assumes, so we'll assume that there are processes. Okay, so the picture that I showed here is what you should keep in mind. So there are processes that are each reading or writing to various disks. So here there are four. Okay. So what strict consistency says is that these processes are assumed to read and write. And we'll allow any valid interleaving of these reads and writes. So long as all processes agree on the same interleaving, and each process preserves its program order. Okay. So here is an example of one that a valid interleaving that obeys strict consistency, and here is one that does not obey strict consistency. Okay. So now let's try to analyze this example. So here is process P1, P2, P3, P4. That's time. Okay, the horizontal axis is time. So there's only one data item here, which is X. Okay. So this notation says that I wrote to X and I wrote A to X. Okay, so to think of it, this is a variable. I basically assigned A to the value of X. That's what this write does. Okay. Then this write assigned B to X. Okay. And now P3 and P4 just read X twice. Okay. When P3 reads this first time, it gets B. Okay. And then when it reads it the next time, it gets A. And then the same thing happens here. When this reads it first sees B and then it says A. Okay. And this is valid, we will, as per these rules here, this is valid sequential consistency. Okay. Even though if you had, let's say, a global clock, you would think that this write occurred before this write. Okay, so that's what the time order tells you. But as far as we are concerned, so long as you all agree on some interleaving, you are fine. Okay, so all these processes agreed, although this is what time axis shows, that this write happened before this write. Okay, so as a result, this read is actually getting the results of this write, and then it is getting the results of that write later. Okay, but since everyone has agreed that these writes happened in this order, we will let that we we'll call it sequentially consistent. This is not strict consistency, obviously, okay, because if you enforce strict consistency, then you should have read A and then read B always. Okay? But we'll allow B A if everyone agrees that's the order in which these writes happened in the system. Okay? Here is a scenario where you are not sequentially consistent. Okay, same example, you are writing A and writing B, but P3, when it reads, it first sees B and then it sees A. And P4 is first seeing A and then it's seeing B. In this case, P3 and P4 are not agreeing on the order in which these two writes have happened. Okay, the replicas at P3 and P4, not P3 and P4 themselves, but the replicas here, basically the disk at P3 is seeing this update and then it sees that update. And the disk at P4 first sees this update and then it sees that update. So the updates have arrived in different orders at two different disks in the system. Okay? Which causes these processes to see the values in different order. This violates sequential consistency because they should have agreed on the same interleave, which this did. Okay. Is that clear? What happened here? Any questions? So this is weaker, but it is a guarantee. Okay. So you could design your system to be sequentially consistent so long as it follows these conditions. Okay. So next one is linearizability. Yeah, so linearizability assumes everything sequential consistency assumes. Okay? But in addition, it also assumes that, it requires that you obey timestamp order. Okay? Which means that if the timestamp on X is less than timestamp on Y, then operation X should precede operation Y in that sequence. Okay? So what this means, if you think about this, is very simply, if P3 and P4, between these two writes, if P1 sent a message to P2 of any sort, okay, that imposes based on Lamport's clock an ordering between these two writes, okay, timestamp ordering. So not only should you agree on the interleaving, you should also agree on that ordering that is enforced by any timestamp Lamport's clock. Okay, that's what linearizability requires. If there is no message that goes between P1 and P2, then we don't care. Then you just agree on some ordering, and so long as everyone agrees, you are fine. But if these processes communicate using any mechanism whatsoever that enforces an ordering between these two writes, then you have to, in addition to all of these conditions, respect that ordering. Meaning you have to agree on all interleaving that also respect that ordering. Okay? Is that clear what linearizability does? So now we will actually look at an example here. So this is three processes. Okay? Now this doesn't have the disk in the picture. Okay? So all that these processes are doing is there are three variables, X, Y, and Z. Okay? You assign X equals 1, Y equals 1. Within each process, you assign 1, and then you print the other two variables. Okay? So what this requires is as soon as you update this variable, this update has to, since you are printing X and Y, here you are reading and printing. Okay, here you are writing. So this is a write. A print is effectively a read because you have to read this and print that value on the screen. So what we are now concerned about is as soon as you update, when do these other processes see that update and what values do they print? Okay. So here are basically four scenarios and they are all linearizable. Okay. So this is an interlink. So at the end, so what you have is what was printed on the screen. Okay? So based on what was printed on the screen, you can determine the order in which these instructions executed within these processes. So this is a interleaving that basically gives you this output. Okay? So you assign X equals 1, you print Y and Z. Okay? Since let's assume you start with zeros for everything. So if you print Y and Z, you'll get 0, 0. Then you assign Y, you print X and Z, that gives you 1, 0, because X has already been assigned 1, Z is not yet assigned. Okay, so you get 1, 0, then you assign Z and you print X, Y, you get 1, 1. Okay? So that's the interleaving here. That's another interleaving that gives that. So the assumption But if you actually look at all of the conditions, the claim is that all of these interleavings, okay, are linearizable, okay, meaning that they satisfy linearizability. So now let me let's just look at one thing here. So just to understand interleaving that is not, let us look at this. Okay, so if that's the output of these programs, okay, the claim is that this is not linearizable. Okay, so you have to understand now how this output can result. So let's go back to these processes. Okay, so if you get 0, 0, any one of them could have run first. Okay, so let's assume P1 runs first. Okay. The only way P1 will print 0, 0 is if it actually executes both of these instructions before any of these. Okay, otherwise, the value of Y and Z wouldn't be 0. Okay, so basically, what did we get? So the interleaving is X equals to 1 print YZ. Okay, these are the first two instructions. And the next two bits are 1, 0. Okay. So basically you have to, since only X has been assigned 1, let's assume this goes next. Okay, because it will then print 1, which is this, and Z is still not assigned. Okay, so Y equals to 1. Okay, now this is printing 0, 1. Okay, you will see that that's not possible. Because you cannot find any interleaving where you will actually get this that satisfies linearizability. Because if that actually executed after this, then you should have printed 1, 1 here, not 0, 1. So you can consider any case and you will find that you will not find some interleaving that will give you that output. Okay, so the assumption is invalid. If you get this output, you should say that these programs did not execute in an order that guarantees linearizability. Okay? Yes, question.
Since there is no communication between different process, we can say that the charts conform to the sequential consistency too. Yes.
Okay. Question is there is no communication between these processes, so can we say it's sequentially consistent? So you will see that there is communication between processes if you actually look at this. Okay? Communication doesn't mean you explicitly send messages. These processes are communicating by reading and writing shared variables. Okay? Because X, Y, and Z are shared. Depending on what you wrote, you read here. So that's some form of sending a message. You write one to a buffer. Okay? And then later on, this process reads that buffer X. That's communication. You actually sent a message. You sent a message saying that buffer value is now set to 1. From P1 to P2. Okay? So by communication, we don't assume the typical communication of sending messages. Reading or writing shared buffers is also a form of communication. If you think about what I said very early on when we did communication, you could use shared memory to communicate. Right? That's exactly what's happening here. There are three processes and they are reading or writing variables. They are actually communicating through shared memory. So there is communication here. Okay, which is why you have to ensure linearizability and this timestamp order is not preserved in this case. So that's why it gets violated. Is this clear? That okay.
Is there any automatic method to validate the output is correct?
Yes, good question. Is there an automatic way to I'm sure there are algorithms that allow you to figure out whether the interleaving is linearizable or not. But it's not, these techniques are not described in the book. I would have to dig at some literature. I mean, there are methods. And the answer is yes, but I don't have one at the top of my head to tell you how to do it automatically. Okay, but there are many papers that have been written on this, which allow you to say whether it is or not. Okay. So the next form of consistency is causal consistency. And this basically says that causally related writes must be seen by processes in the same order. Okay, your question. Linearizability. Okay. Okay, so signature, so depending on how you print it, the signature, these two are the same actually. So the signature just dictates an interleaving. So this signature tells you in what order they ran.
Okay, is it a process ID?
No, it's not a process ID. The signature is basically the output that came out, which imposes an interleaving of instruction. That's so what did the signature do? 110101.
Is it the order of the updates?
I think it is the order of the updates and order in which they're read. Let me get back to you on that. Actually, I forgot what the sig. I thought that they were the same. There is a difference here. Let me look that up. Right. Okay, I'll come back to you next time. Alright. So. Causal consistency. So what does this say? So this says that causally related writes must be seen by all processes in the same order. Okay? A write would be causally related if there is any communication if there are between two processes. If there are writes, then these writes get causally related. Okay? So example is, let's say this is time. Process P1, process P2, write here, and there's some write here. Is a message that goes this way. Okay. This causes these two writes to be causally related based on our definition of causality when we did Lamport's clock. Okay. So this says that if there is any causally related writes, you must respect that causal ordering when you agree on some interleaving. If you don't, then you have violated causal consistency. Okay. So here are two examples. Okay. So here is an example where there is causal relationship between two writes, but you are not respecting it. Okay. And so there are four processes again. So here you write value A to X, okay, and you read X and you get A, and then write B to X. Okay. The claim is this has imposed causality, okay, because effectively what has happened is P1 has sent a message to P2 because of this read. Okay. You wrote A to a buffer and you read this. That effectively is a message that came from here to here. Whatever this wrote, this guy read. Okay. And now this write happened. So now these two writes are causally ordered, and any interleaving should always have this write appear, the results of this write appear before the results of that write based on causal content. And here we don't see that because this process actually sees this write before that write. These updates have arrived in order where this write becomes visible first and that write becomes visible next. Okay? This process is seeing the writes in causal ordering. It actually sees A and then B, which is the order in which everyone should have seen it. So as a result, this is not permitted because P3 is not seeing writes in causal order. Okay? Is this clear? Now if you remove this read, this interleaving is going to be permitted, which is shown here. Okay? Because same thing, only thing is that this read has gone away in that example. Okay, you have this write, and these two processes are seeing them in different orders. Okay, and we say this is fine as far as causal consistency is concerned. Because as far as causal consistency is concerned, there was no message that went from here to here. So these are independent writes. Writes are independent, we don't care about the ordering. Even if they see them in different order, we'll accept it. That's what has happened here. They actually see it in different order. But we still accept that because these two writes are not causally related. Okay? Any questions here? Is this clear what we just did? Okay, so there are two or three other things I will talk, and then we'll move on to other models. Okay, so the next one is FIFO consistency. So we have actually kept weakening the notion of strict consistency. Okay, so in strict consistency, everyone sees the same thing. Right? In sequential consistency, you just agree on an ordering, even if that was not the ordering in which events happened. Okay. In causal consistency, we allow different processes to see things in different order. Okay. Yes, we have a question.
That means consistency does not mean sequential consistency.
Yeah, so I'll talk about the how this is. So the order, the way we have weakened it is we have strict sequential. Actually, linearizable is actually between these two. and you have causal. Then we'll have 5-4. Okay, that's the order in which we are weakened. So this is the weakest, that's the next weakest, that's the next weakest, and so on. Okay? Okay, so that's tech. So 5-4. So 5-4 consistency is last. So here what we say is writes from a process are seen by others in the same order. But writes from different processes may be seen in different order, even if they are causally related. So this relaxes causal consistency one more step. It just says that let's only worry about writes from a process. And so long as the writes from a process are seen in 5-4 order, we don't care. Okay, across processes, even causally ordered writes can be seen in different order. Okay, so what this will basically say is if there was a second write within this process, okay, that you should see that in that order. Okay, so writes within a process should be seen in program order. Across this, we will allow any arbitrary interleaving. Even if there is causality, we will let that write be seen before this write. Okay, so long as you preserve writes in program order. Yeah, so that's what 5-4 is. It just says that only worry about how one process is sending writes to a system, and you should generally see, ensure that that is not violated. Okay, the other interleavings we don't care. Okay, is this clear? What we have said here. So now the other issue is, although this is the weakest consistency model one could think of, where you only worry about one process and how it is processing writes. Even this may be too strong to implement, meaning that the consistency overheads of even ensuring FIFO consistency may be strong. Okay? So what people have done is, rather than looking at read and write operations at individual data item granularity, okay, they have relaxed this to say, let's only worry at the granularity of critical sections rather than granularity of individual reads and writes. So we'll see several models now which work at the granularity of critical sections. So you make reads and writes visible at granularity of critical sections as opposed to when you actually read and write that data item. Okay, so what this would mean, just to give an example here, is you basically say in critical section, and here you may do some operations. So we won't worry about when this write became visible and so on. What we will only worry about is what happened here and what happened here at these boundaries. Okay. So that allows you to make this even weaker, because what happened within this we don't care. We only look at what was the system state when you entered the critical section and what was the system state when you left. This is a little bit similar to the notion of transaction. If you think about it, when we did transaction, we said only after you commit all changes become visible, and whatever happened inside the transaction we don't really care, but this is the entire atomic unit that we cared about in the context of a transaction. Something similar has happened here. This is not an atomic unit, but that consistency is enforced at critical section boundaries rather than at read and write points. Okay? Yes.
So why is it so difficult to enforce?
So question is, why is it difficult to enforce FIFO consistency? So it's not the question of a process. So the example that I drew earlier. And so let's see. So it's all the problem of, let's just take two disks here. Actually three. Okay. So these are three disks. They are separated on a network. Right. So any consistency algorithm that we have seen so far, what is it effectively doing? It is trying to order writes. Okay? In case of FIFO consistency, you are trying to order writes within the same process. Okay, so let's suppose this process issued write 1 and then it issued write 2. This is the order in which this write appeared here. Okay? Now this has to be broadcast to these others. Okay, so if you send messages W1 and then you send message W2, FIFO consistency says that this message, this update should arrive here before that update. That will guarantee that FIFO is given, right? And this should be the case everywhere. So you have to guarantee this. And that is where I think, so when a write arrives, you have to make sure, because you could have arbitrary network delays and things may have gotten lost and retransmitted and so on. You want to ensure that this ordering is enforced. So the algorithm that runs here doesn't just take the writes and just write them out, because it has to make sure that the ordering, that whatever consistency model you have, is enforced, whether it be sequential or causal. All of them are enforcing some ordering. Okay, lot of these are enforcing ordering across processes, which makes them even more expensive. So you might have a write from P1 here and some write from P2 there, and then some of these depends, impose ordering on how these two updates arrive at this disk. Okay, so updates from independent disks have to be now ordered and written out in the order that the consistency semantic dictates. So doing all of that is expensive. That's the only point that is being made.
How does enforcing it only on critical section help?
Right. So how does enforcing on the critical section help? So what happens during critical sections is, because you have locks, right? So you can actually make, so begin see. So I haven't talked about models, right? So here there's a begin critical section and there's another begin CS and end CS. So if you end a critical section here, okay, you can actually flush all of the writes. You can wait until those writes are acknowledged by all the disks and then release the locks, which means that everyone else is blocked because of the lock. So this makes it a little more simple. Right? So if you want to say, I want to make all my writes visible at exit time, which we'll see, there's something called exit consistency and entry consistency. What that means is, I will, although my critical section has ended, I'm not going to release that lock until I actually flush the writes to all of the other replicas. They all come back to me saying, yes, we have seen it, it's gone out to disk. Then you release it and you are guaranteed that all these writes have been made visible. This simplifies things, because you don't have to worry about ordering. You just have not released your lock. So everyone else is blocked who wants to access this data item. Okay? So that's the reason it gets a little more simple than other models. Okay, does that answer your question? Okay. So we'll talk about the models and then we can come back to this and see if that makes more sense. Okay. So if you actually look at look at consistency and the granularity of critical section, you effectively get what is called weak consistency. Okay, so what this says, access. So there are many conditions here, but let's hold off on that and just look at these two scenarios first, because they're easier to understand. Okay, so there are two forms of weak consistency. One is called entry consistency. The other one is called release consistency. And what this says is that, assume the shared data is made consistent either at entry points or exit points. Okay? So if you have entry consistency, before you enter a critical section, at begin critical section time, you not only block to get a lock, you also block until all writes that have been made before are actually have reached your disk. Okay. And the exist consistency says that when you exit the critical section, you will not release the lock until all writes that you made have been sent out and been acknowledged. So this guarantees that whatever, before you enter a critical section, everyone else's updates have reached you. And when you exit the critical section, your updates have reached everyone else. Okay, so you're enforcing consistency at granularity of critical section. So within a critical section, once you enter it, you have other locks, so no one else can update that data item. So you can just go and make whatever changes you want. Then you block, you flush those changes, and then everyone else sees it, and then they enter the critical section. So that's the consistency model being used here. Okay. So this makes it a little simpler, because you have your locks to block other processes from making progress, and you can wait until all your changes have propagated out. Yes, question. So these are two different models. You could either have entry or you could have release. You don't need to do both. I mean, if you have flushed at exit time, it's clear that when someone else enters, everything is consistent, because you have sent all of your changes to everyone. They've acknowledged it. So you can just enter without waiting. Or you wait at entry time, make sure everyone is propagated, and then you just exit.
Okay, so the entry, you actually have to go with the message.
Yes, how you implement is different. That's one way to implement it. You can block, get a lock and says, has everyone else sent me your updates? Okay, that's just one simple way to do it. Everyone else may say yes or send you updates, and then once you get everyone's response, then you enter. That's entry. Exit is you block and just send everything out, wait for everyone to say yes, we have received it, then you actually exit. Okay, release the lock. So, but you don't need both. You can do one or the other. Any questions here? So here is a table that actually shows or summarizes all. So we did a lot of these different things, right? So this gives you a high level summary of everything. So we started with strict, which is absolute time ordering. Okay, assumes global clock, perfect synchronization. You put an absolute time order and everybody sees that in that time order. Okay. Linearizability basically says everyone sees shared accesses in the same order and you respect Lamport's clocks. Okay. So sequential says everyone sees, so you basically agree on some interleaving and everyone has to agree on that interleaving. That's all it says. Okay, so you can agree on an interleaving that violates strict, but so long as you all agree on it, that's all that matters. Causal says that you have to only worry about causally related rights. Okay, if rights are independent, you can actually see them in different order. You don't even have to agree on those order. Only worry about causally related rights and only respect those ordering. And all other rights you can see in any arbitrary order, specifically in different orders on different disks. And that's okay. And FIFO says we'll not even worry about multiple processes. All we will worry about in what order does a single process send writes. And that's the order in which I should see updates from that process. Okay, and updates from arbitrary processes can have arbitrary interleaving. Okay, so which means I can each disk can see different things based on even if writes are causally ordered. Okay. So there is, and then we talked about weak and two forms of weak, which is basically release and entry. So here shared data is made consistent when a critical region is exited, that's release. Entry is shared data is made consistent when you enter. You know, that's a good summary of various consistency models. Now, keep in mind that we haven't talked about algorithms. We only talked about models, and models are guarantees. Okay, we did not say how to achieve this. All we said is, these are various guarantees my system can provide you. And I will pick one that is most appropriate to my application. Okay. Consistency algorithms will actually implement a particular guarantee. That will say, how do I efficiently ensure this condition or that this condition is always satisfied. So we'll talk about consistency algorithms in the next couple of classes. But these are guarantees one could think about that you want to provide. Yes, question. So what weak consistency does is it basically assumes that there is some notion of synchronization. It doesn't mean that this is a critical section. And it basically, as the summary says here, so you basically make things consistent at synchronization time. That's all it is saying. So you don't have to have the notion of a critical section. If you basically have, let's say, lock on X, this is the time at which you will basically try to make sure that X is synchronous, X is consistent before you get a lock on X. Okay. Here you have the notion of a critical section where you may have multiple operations all happening at the same time and then you flush them. Okay. So this is, I think, so the way this actually came out is the notion of weak synchronization was proposed first. And then people said we can actually make that more elegant by ensuring that we do it at critical section boundaries rather than individual synchronization points. Okay, so it is basically a form of this, but something that was proposed earlier. Yes, your question. Okay, what is the difference between A and B? So A is basically saying we will worry about read and write points and try to worry about the ordering of read and write points. B says that we will not do that. We will actually worry about synchronization points and try to make reads and writes visible at synchronization points. Okay. So within synchronization points, there may be multiple reads and writes. We don't care. So the granularity of synchronization here, or rather granularity of consistency here is synchronization. The granularity of consistency here is individual reads and writes. That's the way to think about it. Okay. So this is... the other way to think about it, this is more fine grain because you're worried about individual reads and writes. This is more coarse grain because you're worried about synchronization and anything within that, we don't care because those are the boundaries at which you impose synchronization, consistency. Any questions here? Okay. So I'm going to talk about this and in two slides and then we'll come back to this next time. Okay. We'll talk about an even weaker form of consistency, which is eventual consistency. Okay? So we started with strict, where you actually give proper guarantees. And now what we are ending up with, what's called eventual consistency, where there are no guarantees at all. Okay, so eventual consistency effectively doesn't give you any guarantee. All that it says is that eventually every replica is going to receive the update. Okay, it doesn't say when it is going to receive it, in what order it is going to receive it. It just, only thing it guarantees, updates are not going to get lost and eventually it will reach. Whether it's 1 hour from now, 1 day from now, 1 month from now, it doesn't even guarantee that. Okay? That's the notion of eventual consistency. Okay? Now it turns out that although this seems very weak, almost no guarantees, many actual systems use this. Okay? So DNS is an example of eventual consistency. So what happens in DNS is if you add a new DNS entry, okay, this entry is propagated out to other DNS servers. The consistency model is eventual consistency, which just says eventually things will be consistent. Okay? Typically, the rule of thumb is within 24 hours, every replica is going to see it. And the reason for that is every 24 hours, all these servers synchronize. So you synchronize once a day. Okay? So you update now, within 24 hours, it's likely to propagate. But you don't give a guarantee. So all it says is eventually everyone sees it. Okay, so until then, different replicas may actually see different things, right? So if you actually have seen anything about DNS, you make a DNS entry. Okay, you go and look up that same entry at some other DNS server, you will actually see the old entry, even though it has actually been updated. Only the server where this entry was updated gives you the newest result. And eventually servers synchronize with one another, they receive new updates and records get updated. And after a long period of time, things reach you basically get to a state where everybody has seen that update. Same is true of password databases like LDAP and Yellow Page or NIS. If you update your password, okay, so if you actually have a large Unix system, you have multiple of these NIS servers running. And the NIS server effect is just a password lookup database. Okay, whenever you log in, you enter your login name and password. That login program looks up this database saying, is this the correct password for this user? If the answer is yes, you are allowed to log in, meaning you basically enter the system. Now, replicated NIS databases also use eventual consistency. Okay, so you could actually, if you have a single password across your entire department, you update it in one place, you go and try to log in on another place, it's not guaranteed whether you have to enter your new password or the old password. Okay, because it takes a while for these databases to update. So, in other words, no guarantee. Okay, so eventually things will work out, but we don't give a guarantee. But in many systems, because consistency maintenance expenses are actually fallen to this very weak model where they don't give any guarantee whatsoever. Okay. So here is an example of a scenario where what I said just takes place. So here, this is your database. It could be your DNS or a password database, it's replicated. Here's a machine. Okay, so it basically makes an entry here. Then it goes some other place and reads another replica. If this update, we don't guarantee when it propagates that. So it may see an old value or new value, exactly what I said. Okay. So the only requirement is an update should eventually propagate. Okay, but no guarantees on when. So now this is cheap to implement when there aren't write-write conflicts. Okay, if there are write-write conflicts, there will be problems. So the example is, two DNS servers make update to the same record. This typically does not happen, but if you make update to the same record, then you are going to have a conflict and there will be a problem. Okay? Same is true if you go to one machine, change a password, go to some other machine that talks to another NIS server and set your password to something different, it's not clear which password is going to prevail. If you come back 2 days later, you will not know which of the two passwords is one because this has caused a conflict. One is going to override the other, but you don't know which one. Okay, because of eventual consistency, any arbitrary ordering may prevail. Okay? So you can get problems like that. But typically, this is used when write-write conflicts are infrequent or unlikely to happen. Because in the DNS case, there is a DNS authority and they make changes on their local DNS server. Like if we have a CSDNS server here, all updates to that server come from here. It's unlikely or probably not even possible for some other random person to update a CSDNS record at some other server because they won't have authority to do that. Okay? So since there aren't going to be write-write conflicts, it's okay to let these changes propagate slowly. That's the philosophy. Okay? So next time, since we have run out of time, we look at a nice algorithm that achieves. So now we will actually talk about an algorithm. This is the first one which will achieve eventual consistency. Okay, so we look at actually not one but a class of algorithms called epidemic protocol. Okay, so that is next time. So that's where we'll stop today.